No one thought it was going to be easy. This isn't just about replacing one widget with another. It's not just about whether we can build renewable energy instead of fossil fuel systems. This is about power, and it's about money. It's about power in every sense of the word. And the fossil fuel industry and the history of fossil fuels has cemented wealth and power across the global north. And some of these proposals would really change that. And we need systemic architecture changes unless we're going to redo the mistakes of the past, which we're starting to see.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Climate Emergency Forum. I'm Herb Simmons, author of A Climate Vocabulary for the Future, and I will be your host today. And we have an extra special, extra special guest with us today, Sipora Berman, who's joining us from the country of Colombia, where a landmark international conference on transitioning away from fossil fuels wrapped up just last week. Sipora has been designing environmental campaigns and shaping environmental policy in Canada and around the world for over 30 years. You are a founder and a steering committee chair of the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty Initiative, something that I'm sure many of our viewers have heard of. This is a global network supported both by nations and civil society that's developing a companion to the Paris Agreement to ensure international cooperation for a fair phase out of fossil fuel production in line with climate goals, and most importantly, a just transition for workers and communities. You're also the co-founder and international program director of Stand.Earth, formerly Forest Ethics, where you develop strategy for campaigns covering almost everything, it sounds like, the Amazon, shipping, fashion, pipelines, liquefied natural gas, old growth forests, and safe cities. Also joining us today are our regular panelists, Paul Beckwith, who's a climate system scientist from Ottawa, Canada, and Dr. Peter Carter, retired physician and founder of the Climate Emergency Institute based in British Columbia. And as always, following our conversation, we will bring you what we call the Climate Three, the three biggest climate stories of the past week, each covered in no more than 1 minute each. We hope that you will stay for that. Please like and subscribe to our channel. Share this program with your friends. Visit us at climateemergencyforum.org, where you can donate, and we would appreciate if you're able to, and leave your comments and questions below. So again, thank you so much. You must be, well, I don't know if you're up in heaven with excitement or you've come down after the week of the conference, but we just wanted to start by asking you the most direct question I know how, and that is, what happened last week in Santa Marta with respect to climate change and fossil fuels?
Thanks, Herb. And it's great to be here. You know, what happened last week, I said a number of times, some of you probably read some of the articles that it was historic. And I think that that's right. I don't think it's overstating it. I think people in the Climate Emergency Forum and who watch this podcast know that for 30 years, we've been negotiating the symptoms, you know, that our countries have been designing climate policy and negotiating international frameworks to reduce emissions, to reduce the demand for fossil fuels. But we have no agreements and very little policy to reduce the production of fossil fuels. And what we build today will be what we use tomorrow. And I think for people who understand that, we've been trying to kind of cut with only one half of the scissors, the demand and not the supply. It's no surprise that carbon is accumulating in our atmosphere faster than any other point in history. And so what happened in Santa Marta was the first ever diplomatic conference with governments coming together, 60 governments from around the world coming together to discuss not whether fossil fuels need to be phased out, but how. It's funny, I was in a restaurant last night and there was a Swiss couple beside me and they asked what we were doing in Colombia, and I described it, and they said, "But that can't be possible. It's the first ever conference that's on fossil fuels. That's crazy. Everybody knows that climate change comes from fossil fuels. Why would there never have? What about the 30 COPs?" And they got outraged, you know. And it was interesting watching someone figure it out for the first time, because you know, I don't know. Well, this last COP might have been my 17th COP or something. You know, I've been working on climate change for a long time, not as long as some of you, but for a long time. And it is absurd that this was the first time governments gathered to have that conversation. But anyone who's ever been to a conference of parties or watched the negotiations since Glasgow, so probably about 5 years now, there's been a real movement to force countries to acknowledge that we need to phase out fossil fuels. I like to think that in part started because we started the Fossil Fuel Treaty in Glasgow. That was our first campaign. And it was the first time there was a tangible proposal on the table to governments to create a mechanism to wind down fossil fuels that they had to respond to. And I think that did have an impact. In fact, our first campaign in Glasgow was, it's time to say the F words at COP, billboards. But it forced people to ask the question, you mean we've never said the F words? Most people don't realize that the Paris Agreement doesn't even include the words fossil fuels or oil or gas or coal. And that's, you know, that's because the fossil fuel industry wanted it that way. And they overwhelmed the negotiations. They've overwhelmed climate policy forums to ensure that no one constrained the production of their products and therefore their excessive profits. So back to Santa Marta. So Santa Marta was a kind of coalition of the, I like to say ambitious, because there's a lot of countries that say they're willing, but they're just using bad math. You know, they're saying they're willing to phase out fossil fuels while they're building more fossil fuel projects. My own government, I was actually dismayed to see them there, because having a space that was mostly not the governments that are producing the most meant that it was quite freeing. People could have the conversation they wanted to have. We didn't have to argue, you know, whether or not the words fossil fuels should be in a text. I mean, the Dubai COP, we finally got fossil fuel phase out in the text, but that's it. There was no commitments. There was no plans. It was just like, oh, we got the words in. It's a big victory for humanity. And in some ways it was a victory, but we all know the crisis we're in. It certainly wasn't a big enough victory. So the Colombia government co-hosted this with the Netherlands and this conference, and they decided to invite some major fossil fuel producers. And so there were, Australia was there, Norway, Canada, some other countries, and they didn't hold back the conversation, which I think is great. They didn't distort the conversation to just being about carbon capture and storage or offsets or, you know, not constraining production like they usually do, abated versus unabated fossil fuels, as if you can abate the impact of fossil fuels at this moment in history, which I think is just absolutely absurd. So I think Santa Marta was a really interesting moment. It was the first time that people actually freed their imagination to talk about what could a phase out look like? What would we need? What are the primary barriers to phasing out fossil fuels? And it was not just the 2-day high level with the ministers and the governments. There was a whole week. Once people knew that this was happening, and it really was first ever fossil fuel phase out conference in history, more communities and started organizing. So there was a 3-day academic summit. There was an indigenous convening. There was a people summit. Thousands of people came to. There was also a union roundtable, a business and private sector roundtable. All of these, and C40 and Under 2 organized a subnationals gathering, parliamentarians for a fossil-free future. So it ended up being this full, like, 7 days of conference after conference discussing plans and ideas of how to phase out fossil fuels. It was really exciting.
Wow. I'm excited. And I've read about it 3 times already, but just to hearing the energy in your voice, is it fair to say that the words were intentionally used, it's a phase out, not of fossil fuel emissions per se, but of fossil fuels, that's a kind of a bigger perspective or broader perspective, because the harms of fossil fuels go well beyond the emissions, as critical as that. Is that a fair perspective that I've just articulated to you?
Yeah, that was on purpose, and we've been pushing for it for a long time. Many people have, but look, it's not just because of the impacts of fossil fuels from their development, their transport, their pipelines, their oil spills, all of those things. I mean, that would be enough, that it should also be about production. But it is because of the fact that because there has never been conversations of phasing down production, we just keep missing our targets and governments keep building more and more. You know, my own government in Canada, just more fracking this year, more oil drilling, more LNG terminals, while they say they're phasing it out, but they're only working on the emissions side. That allows these massive loopholes that the industry wants in order to lock in future fossil fuel emissions. And that's one of the reasons we've been so wildly unsuccessful in addressing the climate emergency, because we keep building these projects. And when you build a $40 billion pipeline or a $50 billion LNG terminal, it's not built for tomorrow. It's not built to produce during the phase out. It's built to produce for 30, 40, and 50 years. In fact, if you look at some of the investment bonds that the big oil companies like Saudi Aramco put out in the last couple of years. These are investment bonds saying that they'll produce even more in 2065. You know, these ideas are kind of crazy. And so having governments stand on the stage and say, we are committing to stop expanding production and wind down, which Colombia was one of the first governments to really do that as a fossil fuel producing nation. And let's remember, we were in a coal port. The Santa Marta conference was in Santa Marta on purpose. We were in a coal port. You could see the coal right there. And I think President Petro really wanted it to be there for people to understand, you know, that this is a transition. It's not going to be easy. And here's this country who has way bigger barriers than the US or Canada, Australia, Norway, some of the wealthy countries in stopping expansion because they, you know, they're a developing country. The interest rates are terrible. The credit rating is a problem. They have a huge debt. And for most of the countries in the global south that are currently increasing production of fossil fuels or planning new projects, they're doing it to feed their debt. So there's financial issues at play, which is why we need new architecture and why we need a fossil fuel treaty, because countries need to cooperate for new trade and tax and debt rules in order to ensure that there can be a fossil fuel phase out. This structure that is supporting future fossil fuel production is a financial structure. And so that was all really important and beginning to be discussed, but you'll probably get to this in the questions, but there was also some significant pushback on the fossil fuel treaty and on there being any new architecture. Some of the countries from the global north, especially from Europe, were kind of hell-bent and determined to take all the momentum that we, and when I say we, I don't just mean the fossil fuel treaty, I mean millions of people around the world who have been marching and standing up against projects in their home, indigenous people on the front lines, all of this keep it in the ground movement, you know, the stop oil movement, all of this is what has pushed this moment to the forefront. And they wanted to take that momentum and just stick it back inside the existing processes because the existing processes benefit them. They don't have to make financial commitments and their phase out plans are voluntary. But that might work for some of the global north countries. They could make their own national roadmaps, but most of the countries in the world can't. And so that's why we need new architecture. So there was a real, I saw a real split evolving and a real pushback and fight against the fossil fuel treaty.
You brought up so many critical issues, and you know we can only probably tackle a few, but I'm eager to have us do that. Just wanted to comment that having gone to the COP in Baku and seeing, you know, Baku was sort of one of the original centers of oil production in the world in the 19th century, and the oil tankers all over, I had a sort of similar reaction to what you had. Let me turn it over to Peter Carter. I understand you folks, two of you have known each other for quite a while. I'm sure you're delighted to have the opportunity to chat with each other. So the floor is yours, Peter.
Thank you. And of course, my first word would to you, separate from all of us, would be hearty congratulations. Oh, my gosh.
Thank you.
And it's so interesting listening to you explain everything. I mean, you get everything in there. It's very, very interesting. What I'd like to hear is how did it start for you personally?
You mean the conference or this road?
The road to the conference.
Such a big question, Peter. Like for me, I worked on forest conservation for many years, a decade. And for me, all my work started because of a deep love of the forest and nature. It was somewhere around 2003 or so that I started seeing the maps of fires in the forest and the beetle kill, 2003, 2005, maybe. And started realizing that all of these forests I'd spent my entire life trying to protect and had some great success in protecting, we're going up in smoke because of climate change or getting eaten by beetles because of climate change. And it was that point that forced me to have what I consider my kind of climate reckoning and to understand that the problem was fossil fuels. You know, I didn't really know anything about fossil fuels. That was over 20 years ago now. And I changed my entire work in the world and my entire career and left my forest conservation and biodiversity work and started refocusing entirely on fossil fuels. I'm Canadian. You can't refocus on fossil fuels and not go to the tar sands and spend time in the tar sands. It's one of the single largest and most destructive oil projects in the world. So I started spending some time in the tar sands, working with the Athabasca Chipewyan folks and many others there, and seeing the devastation and the cancers in remote communities because they live downstream. And I have three university degrees. I kept being told when I said, well, what are we doing to phase out the tar sands given climate? Like that I just didn't understand climate policy. I don't understand how the markets worked. I can't tell you how many times I was panel, but mansplained how markets work during that period of my life. And it was, you know, it took me years to actually be bold enough to come up with an idea to actually constrain fossil fuel supply and start working on supply side policy, because I just kept being told, no, 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 that's not climate policy. We're going to reduce emissions, we're going to reduce demand, and the markets will constrain production. Don't worry about that, little lady. So I started working on that in the tar sands. I ended up getting appointed by the government to run the oil sands, to co-chair the oil sands advisory working group to design climate policy for the oil sands. And I realized even a wealthy country like Canada was never going to create policy to constrain production because they were so under the thumb of such a powerful industry. You know, this is the most profitable and powerful industry on earth, literally. They've made $2.8 billion a day in pure profit every day for the last 50 years. And they were holding our government policy hostage. And I kind of said, wait a minute, if this is happening in Canada, what's happening in other countries in the world? And that's when I started reaching out, Nigeria, Norway, other countries in the world. And that's where the fossil fuel treaty idea emerged, is learning about the Pacific Island nations and how they had proposed the Suva Declaration, which was the first ever moratorium on fossil fuels. I think that was 2016 or so. And we built the fossil fuel treaty from that idea, basically, that we should have a global treaty, that it's not okay to stop this one project in the Amazon or this one project over here in Argentina. And that, in fact, the science is very clear. We need no new expansion of fossil fuels and fossil fuel projects, as you know very well. Any more doesn't fit. We already have enough fossil fuels on the surface of the planet or under construction to take us well past 2 degrees if we burn it. So anything we dig up now, we can't burn, or it'll burn us. So that's where the whole idea came from. And we started about 5 years ago, and now we've got 20 countries on board, another 10 who are sitting as observer nations. We were able to play a seminal role in founding this conference, and there are over 4,000 organizations now in 120 countries that have endorsed the idea of a fossil fuel treaty, over 3,000 scientists. So it's growing.
So again, congratulations. I should also say from all of us, thank you and all of your team and people for cheering us up. Wow, we really needed this. So thank you.
Right? Hope is in short supply these days. And I, you know, I honestly feel pretty cynical after the last 20 some odd years of climate policy, but I also really do feel hopeful after Santa Marta for the first time in a really long time.
Yeah, I've always been very suspicious of the word hope on climate change, but with your conference, yeah, Columbia Conference in the Netherlands, yes, indeed. Yeah.
Well, and it's not a one-off, Peter. We got a commitment for a second conference. One of the things going in that I was just like, it can't be a one-off. If it's just a talk shop about fossil fuels and everyone pats themselves on the back, we have to start a separate diplomatic track where fossil fuel industry is not allowed, where the big producers don't come, where governments gather to actually figure out how to plan this. And for a while there, it was touch and go. I didn't know if we'd get the second conference. And there's such a huge pushback internally to take all this momentum and push it back inside just the UNFCCC and the process there. But Tuvalu came forward and said, we're going to do it. We're going to host the second conference. And then Ireland agreed to co-host it. And they've already set a date, the end of April 2027. And so we're already working with those two governments and trying to support them in co-hosting the next fossil fuel phase-out conference. And so that is an outside diplomatic track now on fossil fuel phase-out. And if you look at other moments in history, the landmine treaty, nuclear, chemical weapons, having an outside track outside of the UN where vested interests were holding an issue back was central to actually helping humanity break through. The Ottawa Convention, Canada hosted it. We would never have had the landmine treaty without it. So I feel like we've started a new process now, and it's a breath of fresh air.
Paul, your thoughts?
I think Colombia was a great place to have it. I mean, I like what the environment minister said, Irene Torres. She said, we need to go back to science and base our decisions on science. Mm-hmm. And even the Colombian president, you know, interesting, Gustavo Petro, I wonder, you know, that's an unfortunate last name, Petro, basically said, what I see is resistance and inertia within the power structures and the economy of this archaic energy system. Today, fossil fuels bring death. Undoubtedly, that form of capital could commit suicide, taking humanity and life itself. Humanity cannot allow that. So very powerful statements from the leader and environment minister. And I like the idea that Chatham House rules was used so people could say whatever they felt like. And They weren't worried about being quoted by the media or misquoted. I guess one of the big questions I have, well, first of all, how can Tuvalu hold it? I mean, there's not enough hotel accommodation there for more than Herb just checked. There's very few hotel rooms. So maybe it'll be in Ireland. I don't know. But anyway, the main question I have is, okay, so getting out of fossil fuels, did you talk about the alternatives? Like, I'm sure a lot was talked about clean energy, solar, wind, batteries, electric cars. Did the idea of nuclear power come up? And also, I'm just curious about whether there was any discussion over why China was excluded, because although China is burning coal to build right now, they are constructing 31 nuclear plants today as we speak, and their time for completion is very short compared to the West. Also, to transfer to clean energy, I mean, China's producing half, say, as a ballpark number of solar and wind and lithium batteries, the electric cars. So China's basically producing the materials that the world would need to get off fossil fuels, and yet they weren't at the conference. So just wondering about that sort of dynamics.
First of all, while the conference came out of a strategy session that was held at the Fossil Fuel Treaty ministerial meeting, and it was the ministers at the table of the Fossil Fuel Treaty who said, we want to do our own standalone conference. So while the idea emerged from the Fossil Fuel Treaty, once Colombia decided to host it and then picked the Netherlands as their co-host, it became a different conference. It wasn't just about the Fossil Fuel Treaty, and Colombia and the Netherlands decided who they wanted to invite. They were never very transparent, in my opinion, about what the criteria were or how they made that invitation list. The number of countries I work with in Africa, for example, never got invitations, but then Canada did, and Australia did, and like so it, and then China didn't, and so it really wasn't clear how they made their invitation list. I do know that almost every country they invited came, which was very interesting as well. So I did talk to Minister Mena from Tuvalu about the next conference. He definitely wants it in the Pacific. He wants it in Tuvalu. We shall see. He's working with other Pacific countries and they're trying to design it. It may be that a pre-conference will be held in Ireland or something, but I think the countries in the Pacific are very adamant that, you know, in some ways for the same reason that Petro wanted it in Santa Marta. What Minister Mena said is, we will bring the world here to see what we feel every single day and what we're experiencing. Because, you know, several of not just Tuvalu, but also Vanuatu and other islands are already, there are residents already moving off the island. They're having to move schools and graves because of climate change. They deal with cyclones so many more than they ever had, et cetera. So I think they really want to bring the world there. And they want to show that this is fossil fuel cause. So I believe the conference will be in the Pacific. I think it's a really important point about China. And I know Minister Mena has said that they will create criteria and they will be very clear on who's being invited and who's not. And there was a lot of people talking about how China should have been at the table. And you're right, obviously. I mean, fastest growing renewables industry in the world and electric vehicle industry in the world and uptake in the world. But it, you know, let's also be clear. China is one of the largest investors in fossil fuel production anywhere in the world. And they're doing it all over the world. So, from the Amazon, I mean, the only reason Ecuador is drilling in the heart of the Amazon right now is because of a debt for oil swap with China. So, like, there's lots of examples like that. So, sometimes I think the right hand is not talking to the left hand there in terms of fossil fuel production, but their own domestic policy, certainly, and their development of the renewable energy industry is some of the best in the world, that's for sure. So we'll see. I kind of expect they will be invited, but that will be
Yeah,
up to the countries.
up to the
You know, I
country.
feel like the whole process of movement building on the fossil fuel treaty, developing the idea of the fossil fuel treaty, and then this conference has been a constant lesson in letting go. It's like create something and then you have to let go and see how it's going to evolve. And we can put ideas out there, but only countries can negotiate a treaty, and countries need to co-host a diplomatic conference. And so they'll make it what they will. And then, as civil society, we have to hold them accountable.
I think it's great that the idea originated from Belém, like when during the closing sort of days of the COP, you know, and people just say, well, COPs aren't working, you know, we got to do something else. And then also, I think the reports from this conference you've just had will go to the COP people, you know, as well, that it both did the last COP and are planning the COP 31, the next one. So I have to ask you one question. Was there a lot of talk of net zero? Like, is that the objective is for net zero? Because if we go to net zero and maintain levels of CO2, you know, we're at 431 parts per million. If we got net zero, say when we were at 450 or 460, that's still too high. I mean, was there discussion of carbon removal and also of some of the other methods to buy us time, like talking about, was there any discussion on solar radiation
Sure.
management and cooling or carbon removal or methane removal?
I wasn't in the workshops that were government only in Chatham House rules, just to be clear. So whether those were discussed in those workshops, so there were some things that were open to plenary, and I had badge to be able to get into the high level plenary. And then there were some workshops that were only open to government. And then there's all the other conferences. I would say this was the first conference I've been to where it wasn't as much a discussion on the clean energy, the renewables, or nuclear, or geoengineering, because there is a lot of that at COP, right? And a lot of people like to, commit tripling of renewables and this technology and that technology, and that all needs to happen. But if that renewable energy doesn't displace existing fossil fuel assets, then we're in trouble. And so this conference was designed to focus the conversation on fossil fuels and fossil fuel assets and the decline of production and emissions. And in that way, it was a real breath of fresh air. So of course, there was discussion about the other issues, but this was really focused on how can we create the frameworks that allow countries to wind down both their use and production. There was a real push, interestingly enough, by a very ambitious component of the private sector for real zero, not net zero, led by Fortescue and others. And so the private sector report, which will be on the government website now, the conference website, was very interesting because they basically call net zero a sham and say, we know that we actually need absolute emissions and production decline. And that's what this conversation should be about. And I was really impressed with that because these are some big companies. It's like Kia and Fortescue and others. So that's an interesting piece to take a look at around the real zero, net zero. I think there was an understanding, if you look at a lot of the government statements from the floor, that there needs to be absolute emissions and production decline. I think there is an openness from a lot of countries to see carbon removal as a way of getting back to 350, but not as a way of justifying new production. And with obvious exceptions, Australia, Norway, Canada, the big producers are still saying that they can continue to produce more while using carbon removal or sequestration strategies as a way of reaching net zero. There's a lot less willingness to entertain those ideas at this conference than any other conference. Certainly, that was not the mainstream thinking. And I think, for example, Canada looked foolish. Canada did their speech and didn't even, they were the only country there to not even mention the words fossil fuels. It was embarrassing in that context, especially when you had countries like Nigeria and Colombia, who are like fossil fuel producers, who were saying we have to stop expansion, we need help so we can stop expansion, or everybody suffers, as President Petro said.
When you just now said countries like Nigeria said we need help, that's kind of a segue to where I wanted to take the conversation, which is the sort of, I don't know if it's obvious, but the perhaps the biggest obstacle, which is, money talks, and where's the money? Where's the support? There's so many nations. I don't know how many of our viewers know this. There's so many nations we never hear of, small nations in Africa and South America that depend to a very considerable degree on the revenues that come from fossil fuels, whatever their moral or ethical concerns are. They've got a budget to balance, and they're not getting any help from, major countries around the world. And I know I'm certainly no expert, but I've read over the last couple of years, like the initiative by the Prime Minister of Barbados, the Bridgetown Initiative, and others. Did anything emerge from that week in terms of one or two sort of prime candidates that this is a solid potential financing plan that can be used to equalize and provide the incentives for these countries to do what they want to do but can't afford to do right now?
Yeah, definitely some ideas really rose to the surface. I would put them kind of into three categories. One is on debt management and alleviating fiscal constraints. So, one of the things that we've been doing in the last 3 years at the Fossil Fuel Treaty Initiative is we convened a finance experts panel of only ex finance experts from the Global South. One of the former governors of the Central Bank of the Caribbean, João, is part of that. He's been writing the reports on debt, and a number of energy finance experts. And so we came to Santa Marta with a number of proposals to put on the table. And if anyone's interested, it's all free and public on our website, fossilfueltreaty.org. There's a short briefing on financial mechanisms. There's 60-page reports on the different concepts. One is around a debt resolution facility to support member countries in renegotiating their debt. What we're finding is that when you do a real assessment of the historical debt, a lot of it is just added up in a very poor way year by year. And so, for example, when Ecuador did this analysis, 60% of the debt was forgiven. So there's a lot of ways that you can resolve debt. Debt conversions, debt suspension. But then what one of the really interesting things that is emerging is this idea that Treaty put on the table, but so did the OECD, around a buyer and seller's club. So countries are still going to need to buy and use some fossil fuels during the transition. What if they created their own club? So not depending on OPEC, not just depending on the marketplace. The Fossil Fuel Treaty, our buyer seller's club that we've been designing is it, what if Fossil Fuel Treaty members said, okay, I'm going to buy some fossil fuels. I only want to buy from countries that have committed to stop expansion and wind down their fields. And those countries then get supply certainty and customer certainty and demand certainty, and then the customers get a price certainty. So you're basically creating a reverse OPEC kind of to wind down and support the countries that are winding down there. And then there's other reciprocal market access arrangements and trade and tax agreements that are kind of rising to the surface as well. And the treaty put on the table a new global just transition fund, which would establish a new mechanism to create obligations on states who have been major producers. So we have this concept of historical and differentiated responsibility for who's produced the emissions. It doesn't include production. So the countries that have produced the most fossil fuels in history are the countries that have economically benefited the most, and they're now the strongest countries. So those countries have a responsibility based on equity to address some of these issues. Where would the money come from? Well, each of those countries are now increasing fossil fuel subsidies instead of decreasing fossil fuel subsidies in order to keep their industries alive. Canada's throwing billions of dollars at the industry for their CCS projects, or and even outright buying pipelines in order to keep the industry alive because renewables are cheaper now and than fossil fuels. So it could be done through a redirection of fossil fuel subsidies. It could be done through various wealth taxes. And then there's ranges of options for taxes and levies. And on replacing fossil fuel revenues, it requires national assessments, most of which those countries don't have the capacity to do. So again, if you look on the Fossil Fuel Treaty website this year, we did a deep dive into several countries in Africa that are currently exporting fossil fuels to look at what, how could you replace those export revenues? And it depends on place, because it depends on what else that they could produce, what their population's educated for. And so it really comes down to economic diversification and competitiveness analysis in order to figure out how to replace those export revenues. And then you can also, countries started thinking about banding together to reform some of the major institutions that are pushing them into more fossil fuels. Because while supposedly the world agreed in Dubai that we need to phase out fossil fuels, this year the IMF forced countries to increase fossil fuel production in order to get their loans. And we've got several examples of that. So we need countries coming together and trying to use a collective lobbying power against some of those institutions to change the barriers to stopping fossil fuel expansion. So a lot of those different things were discussed. I was very disappointed, I have to say, in the outcome document, because I think the influence of European nations on pushing against the Global South experts and the Fossil Fuel Treaty is because they're afraid of it. They unilaterally and without any transparency in the final outcome document announced that they would have several partners like ISD and the OECD in discussing finance issues. I'm not saying those aren't great institutions and there are great people working there, but they're Global North institutions. And even though 80% of the submissions into the Santa Marta process called for the Fossil Fuel Treaty, and we have a finance expert panel of all Global South finance experts and put more refined financial proposals on the table than any other organizations, the name Fossil Fuel Treaty does not exist in the outcome document yet. We're still working on it. In talking to some of the European countries, what I heard is, well, people are kind of afraid of a fossil fuel treaty, so it's really important not to talk about a fossil fuel treaty. I think we need to ask ourselves what they're afraid of. I think this is a campaign by some countries because they don't want new legally binding tools. They want voluntary arrangements because that will benefit them. And they want tweaking of the existing financial architecture because that benefits them. And that's a huge problem. And so we need to continue working to ensure growing support from nation states for the idea of a fossil fuel treaty. No one thought it was going to be easy. This isn't just about replacing one widget with another. It's not just about whether we can build renewable energy instead of fossil fuel systems. This is about power, and it's about money. It's about power in every sense of the word. And the fossil fuel industry and the history of fossil fuels has cemented wealth and power across the global north. And some of these proposals would really change that. And we need systemic architecture changes unless we're going to redo the mistakes of the past, which we're starting to see in some of the extractive critical mineral mining, et cetera. Every time you hear about a new project, we have to ask ourselves not just what it is, but who benefits.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you for your frankness because, as exciting as it seemed to be and as positive as many of the articles were, you've really given us a very balanced view of, where it's successful, where it's promising, and the challenges that you experienced and your treaty experienced and many countries. And let's do a quick final round.
I've had a big thought come to me listening to Zephyr, and thank you for explaining things so well. It's amazing. Well, so this is the great news for us, but really, this is the greatest news for all the youth and all the children in the world. So I'm hoping that there's a route that this can be publicized and communicated to them.
I think that's so critical. There was a big youth contingent in Santa Marta, and they organized themselves and they spoke so powerfully from the floor. Let's be clear, the youth have been calling for governments to stop expanding fossil fuel production for a long time. The marches, all of the Fridays for the Future, all of the different organizations were some of the first, along with the faith community, to endorse the idea of a fossil fuel treaty. They're ready for new ideas. They're not afraid of bold ideas. They're afraid of more of the same. I hope this conference gives them hope. I heard from a lot of the youth organizations that they were going to go out and generate more engagement from youth around the world for the next conference. I think that will be really important. I think their voice is really critical. As a mom, it's the hardest. These issues are where they hit home, right? I mean, what we do today, every single project that we can stop, every single piece of momentum that we have, every ton of carbon that we can save going into the atmosphere will change their lives and what kind of life that they're going to live, right? And they know that, and they're angry. But I heard from a lot of youth around the world in the last couple of days since the conference ended, and they're excited because there seems to be like a pathway out, or a new pathway at least, that doesn't seem quite so crazy. And who was it? Is it Einstein who said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again? There is no question that the outcomes in Santa Marta will create greater climate ambition, I hope, within the UNFCCC. And it will mean that more countries get serious in their nationally determined contributions within the UNFCCC to on their national plans. These are voluntary plans. They're non-binding commitments. It's important that the outcomes do land there in the different COPs. But it's not enough. It's not enough to keep us safe. And we shouldn't be afraid of new tools. And the youth aren't.
Well, it's really good to hear that you had such great involvement with the youth in Santa Marta. Obviously, that was all part of the brilliant arrangements. I mean, I've read all the documents. It's all really brilliant and extremely well done. So that's great to hear.
I'm just reminded when you're talking about the every sort of kilogram of fossil fuels affects the future. Sir David King, the former science advisor to a number of British prime ministers, has said a number of times, we had him on our program a few months ago, that what the world does in the next few years will determine the course of the world for the next 10,000 years. I mean, this is such a critical time. We've got to get it right. We've got to get it right urgently and comprehensively.
First of all, regarding the forests in BC and the trees, I was very fortunate a couple of weeks ago to attend the book launch by Suzanne Simard. When the Forest Breeze, Renewal and Resilience in the Natural World, just came out, and already it's a New York Times bestseller, and it's number one in Canada for nonfiction as of this weekend just passed.
Amazing.
So, it's all about the communication between trees via the fungus in their roots and things like that. But, amazing talk. I mean, about 600 people in the church for the book launch. So just a great thing. Getting back to the conference, are you happy with the amount of coverage that it received? Are you happy with the number of journalists there? The NGO people writing about it, things like that. Can you give us an idea, like how many people would have been there. There was some coverage I saw. It wasn't covered like a cop as much, right?
It's much smaller.
Yeah, maybe we can get Nick Breese to write a book about the first conference. He wrote a book called Cop Out. Many people are dissatisfied with the cop. And, we're wondering, 35 years, go to Rio in 1992. I mean, what have we done? Like, emissions are higher than ever. Levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are higher than ever. So, it's very important for us as individuals to figure out ways to remain positive so that we can keep doing the work that we're doing, which I think is very important. So were you happy with the coverage or with the conf, are there things that you'd like to see in next year's conference? I mean, I'd be concerned if it's in Tuvalu because that's going to really restrict the number of people that can go, for example.
Yeah,
It's a
I
very
think
small
it's
island.
yeah. Well, that's
So
going to be left up to the Pacific leaders to negotiate on where it is being held. I'm not sure that the number of people attending the conference is always a good thing. I mean, I'm guilty of it. I've been to 17 or so of them. A COP has between 50 and 60,000 people at it. I would
Which
say, but at least
is
half of them don't need to be there. It's become a kind of zoo, like a conference. People run from event to event and make announcements and press releases that don't lead to much, in my opinion. The ministers need to be there. You need the countries there. And you're right, we need more reporters. There was some great coverage and not enough, nowhere near enough. A lot in Latin America, which is really interesting and really great. You did see coverage bounce around the world. Like we did an assessment and you're seeing significant articles in about 90 countries. And so that's really good. It's not small, but we could have more reporters there, for example. And I think it's going to be difficult. The governments are going to have to really be careful about who attends and who doesn't, because you don't want a restricted civic space. You need to have youth there and indigenous leaders and academics and civil society, etc. It's difficult to restrict it for that reason. But at the same time, it just becomes a bit of a zoo. It becomes too much noise and an excessive amount of carbon to get there, especially in the Pacific Islands. And so they're going to have to
Agree.
figure that out. But I certainly hope more reporters will come. And but I don't think this is the end of the coverage of the conference. What I'm finding interesting now is that I'm starting to read articles in other outlets where now they reference it because they have to. So, Trump says something about whatever, climate is a hoax and, fossil fuels should be increased. And the reporter kind of in an article I read yesterday, I think it was in the Financial Times, the reporter said, however, 60 countries did just meet to plan world's first planned fossil fuel phase out. So it's become a, part of the story. And I think that will have a long leash. And I think that it's good. We need it to, especially if there's a pre-conference organized by Ireland, which I hear might be happening, and then there's the next conference. So we'll have another one in 6 months, and we'll keep. What's really important is not the media in the moment; it's whether or not you create a narrative arc that changes the social norm, that shifts the conversation, and that's what we're trying to do on fossil fuel phase out. And so I'm hopeful. That has begun in Santa Marta and it will continue. I would say there was probably 1,000 people in the actual high level conference attending the full week. I would guess it was more like 8 to 10,000 because there was the lots of people at the Public Citizen Summit, the People's Forum, and the academic conference who didn't get into the high level. So I would say it was probably thousands more. And let's remember, had to be self-funded. We spent enormous amounts of money trying to get people there, make sure that people could come there because the UN is a system. And what I didn't realize until I started working with Global South governments is they're on such tight budgets, they don't even have money to send their ministers to a conference unless the UN funds it. Well, the UN is not a part of this. This is all self-funded. And so it's going to be difficult to continue the momentum. And I think it's also going to be hard because some of the big philanthropic outlets and foundations are pretty invested in the UN. UNFCCC, they spent a lot of money to achieve Paris and they think it's all that we need to have, despite the evidence to the contrary. I think this is a pretty big, bold new idea to have a separate diplomatic track specifically on fossil fuels. So I think we need all hands on deck to be encouraging people to engage in it, whether it's virtually or not. I mean, the government open Tuvalu will also Tuvalu and Ireland will also open up a website and say submit what you think, and they'll read those submissions as part of the outcomes, just like Colombia and the Netherlands did. You can engage virtually, You can help fundraise for it, for either for Fossil Fuel Treaty or for Tuvalu or other organizations who are going to organize the side events. For example, Climate Action Network organized the People's Forum, and they had to do their own fundraising to pull that off. Academics had to do their own fundraising to pull off the Academic Forum, the Indigenous Summit. So I guess if there's one message I would leave for your audience, it's that, you know, hope isn't something we just get to have. Not at this moment in history. It's something we have to create. And this is a moment that needs all hands on deck. I talked to someone yesterday on a podcast, and they were like, oh, it's so inspiring what you're doing. And I said, great, make it what you're doing. We all have a role to play. And there are many, many organizations who are involved in these efforts on fossil fuel phase out and in trying to create the next fossil fuel phase out conference. So dig in.
Well, that's exactly where I was going to take this in terms of any advice, suggestions you have for us talking to you, but more importantly, for our viewers. What can they do? Are there places they can donate to? You've talked about the need for resources. Are there organizations that need volunteer effort? Are there letters that can be sent anywhere? You know, let's not end this extraordinary opportunity that you've given us today with this fire hose of incredible information, and let's use it, let's, you know, magnify it, and let's make it something that's tangible. So tell us what we can do and how we can do it.
The most important thing that you can do, I believe, is to write to your elected officials or to call your elected officials. Mm-hmm. We have to stop thinking of ourselves just as consumers and start thinking of ourselves as citizens. And it matters. Tell them that this conference happened. Ask them if they were there or why they weren't there. Ask them if your country has a fossil fuel phase out plan for production and emissions. Raise the issue. I know from many friends who are now ministers or were in government that they look at those letters and they count them and they have a multiplication table. A handwritten letter assumes there's 10 people out there who think that way, etc. They look at those calls and they look at those letters or those postcards or those petitions, and they help decide what those people are going to work on and whether they're going to care about an issue. And so that's really important. And you know, you can just go to your MLA's office. You can ask for a meeting with your member of parliament or your member of the legislative assembly. You have that right as a voter. So engage in that way. Engage with your media, with your local media. Ask them if they covered the conference, if they're planning on covering the conference. Write a letter to the editor about why you think it's important. Keep it alive. The drumbeat is critical. Find someone who's organizing in your community that you align with, and whether that be virtually to volunteer or donate to an organization, or whether it's actually in real life, and organize. Dust off those placards. People need to see, our decision makers need to see people back in the streets, and we don't have the momentum we had pre-COVID, and that's going to be really, really important. Please donate and join the Fossil Fuel Treaty. It's a big, bold idea. It's run on spit and duct tape at the moment because it's a pretty bold idea for a lot of the big players. And they're watching us and they're kind of interested, but they're also nervous. You know, not to say we don't have some pretty big donations from some philanthropic organizations. We do. And I'm so grateful to IKEA and Minderoo and many of the other foundations, the Waverly Foundations, who are supporting us. But this campaign and global initiative and ministerials and conference facilities, et cetera, is being run on less than I know one pipeline campaign was run on. So it needs money, it needs support. But also every person who endorses and signs up matters, because we're able to then look at that data. And when I sit with a government, wherever I am, and I've done it a million times, I was just in Iceland, I was just in Cambodia, and I sit with the government and I can go onto the network database and say, oh, well, there's already 100,000 people in your country who have endorsed the Fossil Fuel Treaty. Oh, this many scientists, this many parliamentarians, there's support here for this. You need to listen. And that helps get countries engaged because they know that there's already support. And so it is a growing network around the world. All you have to do is go online and endorse it, and then you become a part of the network.
Wow. Well, I think our viewers hearing this, I'm not going to accept any excuse from even one viewer for not acting. So tell us, leave us your comments. Tell us what you're going to do. If you have any other questions on how to do it and where to do it, thank you so much. I know I speak for Peter and Paul and Charles and Heidi, and so appreciative that you've taken so much of your time to spend with us. You've got one of the most important messages and campaigns in the world imaginable. We wish you our support in whenever way, in any way we can. We hope you'll come back and talk with us, maybe as we approach or right after or during Tuvalu or wherever it will take place. And we wish you the best of luck and all good spirits as you move forward. Thank you so much, Savor. To our viewers, I'm catching my breath after that remarkable conversation that we've just had with Tzipora Berman, but it is time to focus on the climate three of the biggest climate stories of the past week. And the first one has to do with three countries, I'll do it very rapidly, in Europe that have taken some very interesting actions this week. Portugal has announced a windfall tax on energy companies, which could significantly reduce fossil fuels. Norway surveys show that the country is overwhelmingly in support of climate action and overwhelmingly in support of the continued use of fossil fuels. So that's the kind of cognitive dissonance that's experienced. And Amsterdam, the wonderful city of Amsterdam, basically has outlawed the use of, not the advertising of fossil fuels and the advertising of meat. And it will be very interesting to see what that does to consumption of either of those two. So that's climate story number one. Climate story number two is not a happy one, and that is that the carbon dioxide concentration was just announced at upwards of 432 parts per million this month. Usually, this is the time of the year when it's the highest, and then it gets lower as, you know, the sort of seasons come and carbon dioxide is pulled down by the new foliage. And the last point I want to make is that we've done a number of reports and studies and programs on microplastics, and new study just showed that now they're determining, in addition to all the other horrors of microplastics, they're heating the climate directly. And a new study has shown, particularly the darker and larger particles. So we can add that to one of the many, many reasons why we've got to find a way to abolish microplastics at the same time we abolish fossil fuels. And of course, the one comes from the other. It's all part of the same system. So with that, let me thank everybody again for a wonderful program today. We encourage our viewers to leave us your comments, your questions, to donate to us. And as always, we will see you next week. Thank you so much. Goodbye.